This is Xformation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today I am joined, as always, by my colleague, Caden. And today we're talking about rural broadband. Caden, what's going on? You're from Tejas.
I'm from Texas. Yeah, I'm from the west of the Texas. And
do people say Tejas in Texas, or is that like a no-go? Is that something like you're not supposed to say like Nolens if you're not from New Orleans?
No, we say it a lot, mainly because we all took the same Spanish class, and that was the one word that we could all like hang on to.
Oh, really?
And knew that we could speak Spanish at least Tejas. A little bit, and it was Tejas.
So today, rural broadband, right? So
rural, how do you say it?
I can say it because I'm from rural America. I mean, clearly.
I think that I'm from rural America, too, but I really try to emphasize the two R's in rural.
Yeah, look at that. I know. Do you know how much I've been made fun of for this? I've been made fun of by the big city folks when I used to live in Chicago. They used to make fun of me for this.
For saying it correctly, rural.
Yeah.
How do they say it? I want to hear this.
They say exactly the way that you say it as well.
Rural?
Anyway, let's talk about broadband. Let's actually talk about
okay,
broadband.
So I have a lot of questions about broadband. And mainly it lies in the fact that I always thought 25.3 was just really wanting. And that is from my area of the country in rural Tejas, Texas. 25.3 was about as good as it got. And that's within the last decade. Right.
Yeah.
So then there's this whole thought of putting gigabyte speed everywhere, laying fiber down in the ground, or using Elon Musk's satellites for internet to provide access to everybody. And I have a slew of questions because I know that all of the solutions that I could come up with are pretty dumb, pretty vague. But you, sir, you know a thing or two about broadband.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, yes. Yeah. So first on that 25.3 question, right? I think that you're hinting at this, what is broadband and what should broadband look like? I mean, currently you're right. I mean, 25.3 is effectively what the FCC has as its broadband speed.
What does that
threshold mean,
25.3?
So 25 megabits download, 3 megabits upload. Look at this. Look at the pacing that we're going through already. I appreciate
it. We're just
this.
Killing it over here.
So the 25.3, So 25.3 is it's industry shorthand, right? But 25 megabits down, 3 megabits up. So the idea basically is that you have some sort of threshold between what is determined to be broadband and what's not determined to be broadband. I never know how to really think through this question first and foremost of what broadband even looks like, right? So the FCC has never really looked at the market in a very comprehensive way and said, hey, here's at least just some of the minimal justifications of the reasons why we're doing 25.3. So
why that's basic access.
Yeah. I mean, they really haven't done it. I mean, it appears in kind of fits and starts, but why is it that the agency itself has determined or has suggested that this is supposed to be the speed threshold? What it really comes down to is it matters.
Basic access even really mean, right? If it's 25.3 and that's basic access, does that mean basic access for all? Or does that mean just that's the minimum threshold you have to provide if you want to be an internet provider?
Yes, that in order to be an internet provider, that's the basic speed. Yes. So there is no requirement that you have to have 25.3. It's just that it's being used it's used for funding, right? So if you're getting federal funds, you have to be a lot of the targeting is below this level. So if this speed is not, you know, or at least the most recent round of money that went off from the FCC, it was really, really determined by this speed threshold.
But you're saying that it's just superfluous. It's just arbitrary, this 25.3 distinction.
I mean, effectively, yes.
At the market?
No, it really – I mean, the FCC won't make a market determination and say here's what people want in the market and here's what they're demanding. I think this is a big problem on both ends when you're talking about it, right? On one end, it's like, well, what's the justification for this 25.3 standard? Mm-hmm. And then the other justification is, well, why don't we just bump it up since we're just kind of doing it in a non-deterministic way? Like what?
Easy peasy, right?
Yeah, right.
No big deal.
I think it kind of works both ends. But at core, you're really talking about and really trying to get at what is the service that individuals need to have in order to have, say, super, you know, super, some, a business of some sort, right? So that's right. a question that may exist, or
so like taking or orders from an apps at your yeah. restaurant, or
exactly, which is actually pretty information. Low. Honestly, it's pretty low.
Yeah, it doesn't take a lot.
Yeah, no, it really doesn't take a lot. What ends up happening is that the even the 20, like the 25 to 50 megabits speed range, right? That suffices a lot of your requirements. And now, obviously, since I have the window open, you can hear the airplanes flying by. So I apologize for that.
Hey, we're just
this is a very here. Ad hoc sort of podcast that we've determined. This is a rough draft of everything. Everything's a rough draft, but
well, then again, I mean, we just spent at least a minute talking about rural versus rural. Right. So
that's very true.
You got to get people to the point of what they need to know. And if you're going to rural America, where I'm from, for instance, how do you justify getting gig speed to them without having to lay miles on miles of fiber? What's that going to cost? Not how you justify it, but what's it going to cost just to do all that?
Yeah, that's potentially a very big number.
Because they don't have gigabyte speed where I'm
so from. So some places do, right? Some places actually do. Exurbs more commonly will have fiber speeds, right? So really? Some areas do. It just depends a lot on how well connected you are to a large city. So you lived in West Texas, right? So yeah. I mean, you weren't really connected. I mean, how big was the biggest large city that you were near? Like 100,000.
Well, so my city was 30. Yeah, Midland was maybe at 100,000-150,000.
Yes.
Lubbock wasn't far off. It was like an hour and a half away. That's 250,000 now.
That's still pretty like, these are small, relatively small pockets, right?
Right.
I'm not talking about like you being.
It's not like Trent, Texas, where there's like 100 people in the town. It's just.
Yes. And it's also not like Dallas, right?
Right.
And
definitely
so that's
not like Dallas.
So that's the other side of it that I'm talking about. So when you're talking about the rural area of Dallas, right, the likelihood that, like, say, a rural area, what you would consider an exurb of Dallas, yeah. they're much more likely that even in like your density level, say that you're like in the same sort of density level as even a suburb, like it's much, much more likely that you're going to have faster service at a lower price in the Dallas region or right. the exurb of Dallas than about anywhere else. So this question that you're asking, I think, is really fundamental, which is how do you get speed out to places? I think actually much more importantly, it's where do you get speed and how you get speed and broadband funding out to places that are, you know, that are effectively that aren't connected to a Dallas, right? That are separate geographically from large economic hubs, because right. that's actually where I think you see a far bigger problem, right? That they tend to have fast-ish speeds in downtown regions of these rural hubs, but you go quickly outside of the city, maybe like half a mile outside the city, or even, you know, in the case of where my grandparents are from and where I grew up in part in Southern Illinois and rural Illinois, there was this line, right? You could see this actual yeah. very specific line between the area that was in town, and in town you had relatively good internet service. Now, it wasn't amazing, right? But you had relatively good internet service in town as compared to where my grandparents lived, which was in the middle. Basically, I mean, they had no connection to anything, despite being very close to a large city. Or
well, it was
to
all farmland, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a farm city, right? It was only 6,000 people who lived in there. So it's still small, but and it's also not connected to any other metro region. But again, this is actually a very common pattern, right? That in a downtown core, in the main street, you'll find mm-hmm. not super fast service, but it'll be relatively fast service. But where you really do see a problem and where you do see a super quick drop off is where my grandparents would live, which is they effectively had no, and they still effectively don't have any broadband service as determined by the except for satellite. They do have satellite, which they are using, which is, but
yeah.
Satellite also
but,
is this.
But what you're saying is they don't have 25.3
the fiber,
direct
right.
direct to the line. Well, yep. How do you say it? Direct yeah. service line.
DSL. Yeah.
DSL. Is that what I'm saying?
Digital subscriber direct line. Port. Yeah. But that's based on telephone technology, which is what they would probably have, right? And that's where you see a lot of those older regions would have an upgrade path. And to be very blunt, that's where I think we're probably going to be going, and that's where we have been going. So to put this into context, right? I know we kind of started off with the Internet for All Act. We kind of just briefly mentioned it.
Oh, I don't think I've actually mentioned it yet. Was literally my next question is, does the Internet for All Act get it done? Does Biden get it done? His infrastructure package, is he gonna help us?
Well, so yes, to really go through, I'm unconvinced. So speaking very specifically about the bill, I'm unconvinced.
Why?
But
well, you've got a new piece on it. I think I know why, but I'd like to hear it in some more simple, plain language that isn't like
plain language. Yeah,
super heavy in policy.
Yeah, that isn't tears to my eyes. Yeah, that isn't thousands of words long. No, I mean the Internet for All Act, I think, is the natural outgrowth and it's the natural evolution of where we've been going in policy. So I think it's a law that has kind of a natural evolution from where we've seen previous acts by the FCC. So by way of context, I mean, what we've seen is that the FCC late last year closed what was called the RDOF. So it was the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. And this was basically a fund to get support. And it was structured support from the FCC, right? So they have programs that are supporting rural areas and getting broadband to rural areas. And this has been one of the projects they've been working on.
Wait, this isn't new? This isn't a new push?
This isn't a relatively new push. No, I mean they've had broadband support. Now, so they had a version of this called the Connect America Fund, right? So yeah. that was kind of like the pilot project of this. So RDOF is its own singular thing, right? It's its own unique thing, to be very, very, very clear. But so RDOF is this auction, right? So RDOF is this what you would call a reverse auction. And basically what the FCC was doing was giving a level of support, a support level, to provide service in an area that did not have broadband at this speed threshold that we were talking about earlier, right?
The 25.3.
Yeah. So the FCC was looking at these regions and they determined which regions needed funding. And so then, you know, large broadband providers said, hey, you know, we'll go in and we'll provide service at this level. We'll support you at, given that, you know, that the FCC is auctioning off these support levels.
Yeah.
So where we're at then with the Internet for All Act, in a sense, is that we're still kind of at the end of this big funding push already by the FCC. So the idea to put something like, say, I think that the current projections are to put something like $60 billion into a national fund, right? So there's $60 billion into a – yeah, it is. Wow. It is a lot.
Is that what it's going to take? But then there's a dichotomy.
Look at how I'm reacting.
Yeah, no. For everyone who can't see Will's face, it's just cringing and smiling, and it's coming back too. And it's
we don't know at all. We don't really know what the cost structure is supposed to be. I shouldn't say we don't know what the cost structure is going to be. We don't know what the cost is supposed to be, or we don't have a good sense of what the cost should look like right now. The last time
you
this
don't
was done,
just mean like what the cost is to lay it all out. You mean like what the cost is to. There's something weird about this, right? Like the cost structure is.
Oh, yes. There's
not traditional
parts. Yeah. So there's two important parts to this, right? That when we're talking about building out infrastructure, that fundamentally, when we're talking about building out broadband, there's the first problem, which is that we really don't have a good sense of where currently service is needed, right? The maps just aren't in a really, really good place. And that's where the FCC has been criticized in the past. That's where RDOF had its own complications, was the maps that the FCC uses to auction off these spaces and auction off this level of support have to be kind of based in some sort of reality. And that's the big, big problem that we're facing right now, is that the maps themselves are just not fine-grained enough to do the kind of thing that we need to do, which is provide very, very, very targeted support, right? We need to target support to very specific communities and very specific areas that don't have them, because that's actually the kind of problem that we're facing right now in the market. Yeah. So that's the first thing. You got to figure out where you even need to put the money, and that will determine what the price structure needs to be. But then
sounds
the more
standard.
But again, so that's the first thing you'd need to do, and the FCC hasn't done it, or we don't have the ability to do it right now. And then the second thing we need to be considerate of is what the actual cost structure of these regions are going to look like, because which is what you were talking about, which is this problem. There's this kind of dual problem that you have when you're talking about these kinds of services, right? So there is there is a level of, there's a level at which, so let's just kind of start with fundamentals. Okay. The fundamental problem of rural broadband is cost. It's just a pure cost problem. It's super expensive, and it can be upwards, you know, in the projected cost is super high for getting broadband out to rural houses, right? So in some cases it's something like $90,000 or $100,000 per home.
Oh yeah, that's just like to dig a trench right next to the road and run it from house to house.
Yep. But that's considering that your house may be, in the case of some areas, your house may be the only house for a mile. Now, because you're the only house for a mile, then, you know, you have only one house per mile as compared to, say, you know, a dense urban regions, which will have, in a mile, you'll have many, you know, potentially hundreds of households. Yeah. So the cost structure just looks very different when you get out into rural regions. But there's a really big, important part. It seems probably the last 2% of all households, which is that for that last 2% of households, that the money that they would be getting in, just the normal, what's called an operating income for a company, wouldn't be able to actually support a company, period. So basically that it's that when you get down to these super dense areas, I don't know what.
Well, it's rural areas.
The ruralest of the
rural. Extra rural.
So those areas have a very weird cost structure that effectively the money that you're getting on a day-to-day basis, that you're getting on a yearly basis, is not even enough to maintain just pure operations, right? That's a big, big, big problem. That means that this last portion, this last 2%, needs some sort of continuous funding in order to exist, in order to be maintained, in order to be operational. So otherwise they shut down, right?
Operated at a loss. They just,
yes. And how is a company going to operate at a loss for 20 years or 30 years, right? You just can't do it.
Right.
So there's this big, big cost projection at the very, very end of the most rural areas. Traditionally, the last time the FCC actually did this cost number, so I didn't mention this, but the last time they did this was in 2017, and they said it was about $80 billion. Yeah, that was
It was $80 billion.
Did you say 4 years ago? Yeah, I guess it is 4 years.
Yeah, that's 4 years ago, doesn't it?
Based on 2015 data. So,
oh wow, that's even worse.
Yeah, because there's a delay in the data that the FCC gets, so it's actually based in 2015 data. But again, so we don't have, you know, now we're talking about what, 6 years, at least 6 years, potentially seven, depending on when that 2015 collection came up. I don't remember when the collection came up, because that again takes time for companies to actually, you know, go through their processes. No, yeah. So regardless, so we're in this really weird sort of problem, right? That this last 2% is the toughest to get connected to, and yet through basically all bills and every single kind of support mechanism or most support mechanisms that we're talking about, we're not going to be able to connect that last group. The FCC, however, has said that they've been able to solve this problem through the reverse auction, and that's
right. But you're not. I don't know that idea, are you? Because that's what RDOF did, right?
Yes,
RDOF is a reverse auction. What is a reverse auction? That's sort of where I need to start off first, right? What is a reverse auction?
Yeah, reverse auction is so there's an auction where many people bid for a single item, right? So you basically have one seller and many suppliers. A reverse auction is very similar, but you're a government that is soliciting bids. So a reverse auction is literally just the term for any time that a government entity or a buyer of a good solicits bids to be supplied with, as compared to the reverse of that, which is a normal auction, which is you have something to sell and you're selling it off to multiple buyers.
So then how did that work out for RDOF? Did it actually do some good with the rural internet stuff?
I mean,
was it useful? Did it help anybody? Was it
No, we don't know, right? We don't know at all.
Well, why?
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, why?
Because the money's just went, the money hasn't even, I mean, money is only now just going out, right? So
really?
The money is only now just going out, right? The support service only just finished in the end of last year. The money is basically going to go out over the next, it's supposed to be projected over the next, you know, I forget what this first tranche is. I think it's over 5 years. And then a second tranche is, I think that's how that works, but I could have that mistaken. But so still, so what we're looking at is this money hasn't even gone into these areas, right? Yeah. You still don't actually have service, or you don't have any data. We don't have any data right now to support it one way or another, to really see what's actually happening with these rural areas. We have the data on the areas that got service and support. Uh-huh. And I'm kind of working through that now myself. Even really good fine grain understanding of RDoF hasn't been done yet, right?
Wow.
Just like which regions got it, where, you know, just general expectations, you know, just connecting it with a larger kind of more, I mean, I'm sure that some private companies have done this and have sold this money, you know, sold this off to,
right,
to clients, but,
and then they just keep it in house.
Yeah. But for like the academic people that are, you know, for the policy people that are following this, there really hasn't uh-huh. been anything like extremely extensive done. I would assume there probably will be something that's coming out later this year on this. That being said, that we just don't know how well this works, right? We don't have a good right. sense of how well this project would work. Or the rest of the FCC projects, for that matter. Like, we haven't even...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying maybe it's not such a good idea to put so much faith in the FCC. Maybe there needs to be a little bit more? Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that what we really need to do is first and foremost get a... We need to figure out what it is that we're trying to support, right? What is it that we're yeah. actually trying to do with this money? Because the bills as they currently exist, the Internet for All Act, and really the discussion that you even see with the Biden administration are really of two different ilk, right? There's this one problem of closing the digital divide. And right. on that, I think that it's really, really difficult unless you – so a lot of people, policymakers and you know, and leaders in Congress are really saying, mm-hmm. hey, this is the Internet for All Act and all these kind of similar sorts of bills. This is the way we're going to solve the digital divide. My point is, yeah. is that one, if you're talking about digital divide is a far more extensive problem than just the broadband hasn't been supplied, right? The broadband problem, or what you would call the broadband availability gap within yeah. the digital divide, is only one small part of the digital divide. So there's that sort of issue, right? So if we're just trying to solve the digital divide, this is not the bill for it, right? There are other pieces right. of the bill that I think are interesting that are trying to get at this demand problem, right? Which is the big, big problem that we're facing here, which is that sure. people have access to broadband. They're just not buying it. So even in rural regions, we have this sort of problem that people aren't buying broadband at the level that you would want to have continued more development and more support in those areas. Right.
Because
it's not just a supply problem, it's a demand problem. I mean, yeah. Well, yeah, was that? No,
you live in rural America for a reason. Either you want to be left alone, you've got a green thumb, or you're out there doing something else. But one of those reasons is I want to be left alone. I want to do my own thing. I don't really need access to your internet with your crazy ideas. Which is kind of an important thing. Like, you can't just force internet on
them. Right. Yeah. This is the relevancy problem. I mean, yeah. We pushed my grandmother. I mean, my grandmother, you know, bless her soul, she's still alive. You know, we've pushed her for years to try to do more broadband service. And when my grandfather was alive, we did the same thing. He had no desire mm-hmm. to do that, right? Like, we were there every once in a while. It wasn't really that big of an issue for him. So, yeah. and he used it every once in a while, but he wasn't really, you know, he wasn't all that online. All this is to say is that when you do talk about rural broadband demand, that's also a big problem when you're talking about the rural broadband problem.
Right.
But when we're talking about the Internet for All Act, its ability to solve the rural digital divide and the rural broadband problem, all these kind of related infrastructure issues, is really, really, really minor compared to the broader problem of the digital divide, which is a lot about relevancy, right? It's about yeah. cost. Cost is a big issue. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'd much rather just give individuals money, just straight cash payments or a voucher, really? Which has been talked about for years. Uh-huh. I would much rather give individuals that sort of payment than kind of going through this, like, okay, let's support local deployment and development, which can have its benefits in some regards, but that's not really, I think, the best way to really solve the digital divide, right? But let's take that and let's step aside for the digital divide. this bill, the Internet for All Act, is not really a digital divide bill, period, right? At first and foremost, what it's trying to do is get gigabit service to areas that don't currently have gigabit service.
Yeah.
And that's the way that the bill is structured. The bill is structured very, very specifically to have gigabit service at the top end and then basically provide in a second, like basically there are two kind of reverse auctions that the Internet for All Act is suggesting. The first auction right. would give it towards gigabit service, right? And be very, very uh-huh. focused on that. The second one would be basically everyone else. And I kind of have a philosophical problem with that.
Well, you're quite the philosopher. I need to hear this.
If you're going to support people, support people, right? I mean, if you're going to support people, support them.
Yeah.
Yeah. This fundamentally is driven by an idea that space should not be a limiting factor in an individual's economic outcomes, right? That
like really how far they are from the town, how far they are from the city,
or matter, right? Hub.
Yeah,
it does. It does very importantly, which is
absolutely
the problem of rural policy writ large. There is this really big issue with rural policy that we talk about, which is basically
that thing you had me go research for like an hour. What is it? The rural tax, right? Isn't that what it's called? Something.
The rural tax, the rural penalty.
Yes, yeah. the rural penalty. It's the cost of just living away from big cities. You miss out on so much, and it affects your economic outlook.
Right? Yeah, no, it's a space penalty. It's an agglomeration penalty, really. So because you're not connected to the nearest area, you have a penalty. The further you get away from a central business district, you actually are going to have worse economic outcomes. That actually adds some really interesting problems with urban policy, which at some point I hope we can talk about. But the rural penalty is a really interesting problem because this in part is what was, and I know that we kind of prepped a little bit about this and talked a little bit about this, mm-hmm. was the rural electricity, right? The rural electricity.
Let's go back to 1936, right? With President Roosevelt, and having basic access to electricity is just sort of, it's a no-brainer. We need to get it out.
Yeah.
You take it from here. You're the one who wrote about it.
This is one of those rants, right? Like in the back of your mind, or maybe it's just in the back of my mind, I have one of those. This is one of my rants that I constantly go on, mm-hmm. Which is the fundamental problem to have just rants in the back of your head where you just, you're like, No, you're wrong. So it's important to know. It's really important to know where we came from. So you're right. We had the Rural Electricity Administration, REA, and it was created out of it came out of the New Deal, right? So it was one of the New Deal projects. And it was a very specific and limited program. So what they mainly were focused on, so most of what we've been talking about today, almost all of what we've been talking about today are grant programs of some sort, right?
Right.
We're talking about big grant programs. Now, some of the projects have a different sort of grant, you know, percentage size. So some of them only require that you have like 20%, you know, your own capital in, you know.
Right. It's like a contract. It's like you're negotiating with the government saying, hey, I'll do this. If you give me the grant, I'll take your subsidy and I promise to do this other thing. That's
exactly
important.
This is as compared to what the REA was all about, which is about loans because fundamentally this is they were in a very different place. And arguably in the 1930s, there was just a very different sort of problem that farmers dealt with, which is that I really can't parse this in a very like fine grained fashion because there's a lot that's going on in this time period. But
if I understand it correctly, they're just trying to put food on the table. Who gives a crap about electricity right now?
Yes.
Is that kind of it?
So then I think it's a slightly different question. The question is, why didn't banks back in the 1930s loan to farmers to get them connected to electricity, right? Why didn't banks back in the day provide those types of loans?
Well, it's because it didn't make them any money. It didn't help them pay back the loans.
So that's what the scholarship says in part. And that's the argument that the electricity companies made. And yet, when you look at it, it seems that they did start to loan after the federal government went in and basically said that we're going to support these types of loans, these X, Y, and Z loans. So it's an interesting sort of question, right?
Yeah.
And it's one that is clearly the case that they didn't support them beforehand, but afterwards, once the government basically went and said, hey, we're going to underwrite these loans, generally speaking, then there was more development locally afterwards. So you above and beyond just what the government provided. So let's step aside for that, like, really technical question, right? And that's a really interesting, I think, technical question, but it's still about a loan, right? You're still giving a loan to farmers. Farmers at the end of the day are still,
they still got to pay it back.
Bingo. Yeah. And that's still what happens. So that's one big thing that when we're talking about the rural electricity, that it's just not the same. The second big thing, which I have pressed over and over again, well, there's actually two other major issues. Another major issue is that the REA did a lot of work and was very helpful in drumming up demand. So we've talked a little bit about this problem of demand, that people don't see broadband as being a relevant technology.
If there aren't enough subscribers, you're operating at a loss.
Exactly, right? You have to have a take rate of it's called the take rate, right? You have to have a take rate of a pretty high within your market in order to maintain or be operationally positive or to, maintain the company.
I'm no economist, but I'm following you. This is all I can say.
Nice. All right. See, then the this second is progress.
Thing.
This is progress.
Now the second thing. Right, exactly.
This is progress, right? So yeah, that is the second thing, though. That is the second thing.
That's the second thing
about rural electricity. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, the second thing about rural electricity is that there was a lot of push by REA for demand, and specifically on demand. So separate from this grant loan program distinction, the REA spent a lot of time trying to get price. So they spent a lot of time trying to get people to want electricity, right? So they went and they had like a roadshow. Mm-hmm. So that is something. Right. Yeah, it was actually kind of cool. I was looking at it. And they had like little like That's Western like people with like little pop guns, right? And it was actually fun. It was pretty cool. Yeah, so it was like a little roadshow, and they would combine it with other like local rural programming, so it wasn't just going on with the REA. So there was other things that were connected with this like this roadshow, this demand roadshow. So that's the second issue. The third thing that really is very distinctive and different between the two. And let me add a fourth because there's going to be a fourth one in there as well.
Just to like tie this all back in, just before we lose the point, this is what's different about rural electrification and rural broadband.
Yes. Yes.
Because a lot of people confuse the internet with electricity, like public utility stuff. So this is important. All right.
This is important because effectively, what we're talking about is the difference in how to have a successful project, right?
Yeah.
So what I've been suggesting is that we need to be doing and thinking a lot more about demand, which is exactly what the roadshow in the rural electricity administration did, REA. So I think that's very, very key that a successful program should have a far bigger component in the demand side is what I'm trying to suggest here. Hence the reason I'm making these dichotomies, because I think these dichotomies are actually really, really important. And more importantly, if you're saying, hey, let's do something that we did with rural electricity, the stuff that was important with the REA isn't just the loan program. It's all the other additional things that the REA did.
Got it.
So
you can't just throw money at it.
You can throw money at it. You can try to throw money at it, but you have to throw money in various regards, right?
But you got to take the money to the right place. You got to put it on a cart and take it to the right place hire a manager.
Exactly. Yes.
And you got to go out
with the expectation
to buy the thing. And
with the expectation that it's going to have a certain kind of expected change.
So then that all brings it back. You can't just throw money at the FCC and say, hey, distribute it.
Yes.
There's got to be something else, right?
So I just want to hit these last two.
All right,
I want
you to hit three and four.
Just real quick, because I think that really brings us full circle to all of this, right? So point number three really is that there was the REA spent a lot of money trying to get costs of electricity down. That is something we have not at all talked about within this conversation. And maybe we can do a follow-up on this conversation about the other side of all this, which is that, there's a really big cost structure.
It didn't get the cost down. That just hit me, what you had said.
Yes, that you're not even working to get the cost down, right? So the government actively tried to reduce the costs in the 1930s. They were working on fundamental research to make everything cheaper.
And that failed. that
point? No, it was actually very successful, right? It was actually, it was like connected to research and R&D grants. So that is not something at all that we've, that is part of this project, is that we should be figuring out how to provide service at a cheaper level, right? Like, if we're going to do this, let's also spend money. You know, if you're going to spend $100 billion, and like, I just don't think that it's, there's some very serious problems, I think, that you have with spending $100 billion on broadband. At least think cogently about what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, so, at least try to buy the best thing. Don't just buy a bunch of DSL modems and hope for the best.
Exactly. Or buy a whole bunch of fiber and then say, hey, why is it that we did not have all of these economic, you know, lifts? Why didn't this have a huge economic lift in these rural, poor areas? And it's like, well, we even still spent fiber, but we didn't do it intelligently, and we didn't think about how to put it through the maps, and we didn't do X, Y, and Z. So the fourth thing, the really important thing about electricity is about productivity. Productivity after electricity came in, it is was markedly different. It's really hard to see that sort of big, huge economic lift in rural regions with super fast broadband. That's a really big fundamental.
So you're saying electricity improved everything. That's the market.
And it's very clear that it improved everything, right? You can see a very marked increase in how the economies did before and after electricity. Before and after.
What about this argument that, you know, getting super fast internet to these rural communities can help them get access to things like telehealth, or with 5G coming down the pipe, there are like robots you can dial into that have hand motions and they can perform surgery on you. You can have the best surgeon in the country come or dial into this thing and perform surgery on you.
Yeah.
I mean, if they don't have gigabyte speed, it's not happening.
So sure. I mean, you could have that. What, I mean, there's a lot that's, I think, related to that. One of them is, again, on the, I actually think there's a bigger problem, or at least traditionally, there's been a bigger problem on the supply side of telehealth, that that doctors effectively just weren't really all that capable of doing it. But now we're in a different space. So there's that sort of thing, which I think will clearly occur, right, with regards to telehealth. But when you're talking about rural areas, if you're saying what happens when you inject a whole bunch of super fast broadband, you're right. You get access to telehealth, but also you get access to Amazon, right? And Amazon substitutes for local retail.
And
so
Netflix.
You start
don't forget about that.
Netflix. Yeah. So basically all of these things that are cheap and easily accessible on the internet start substituting for whatever your local economy is. And
so you actually see the Walmart that dominates my hometown, or
yes.
That's
a super controversial question too. What happens when Walmart comes into a region?
Tell me about it.
That is not clean, because there's a whole bunch of other changes that typically go along.
Yeah. An entire downtown area just got wiped out basically.
Yes. So you'll have
my town.
Yeah. So why? Okay. If that's the case, and generally speaking, we see substitution among consumers clearly, right?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we expect that also for rural broadband? I mean, this is exactly what's happening. And we do see this, right? We do see this kind of skill change. Again, I would qualify the Walmart thing, because that, from what I understand, is very, that's a very controversial space.
Just to make it
clear. No, that's fine. I don't want to speak on it, because I'm not up to date on the literature.
Okay. All right. Yeah, sure. Sure you aren't.
Yep.
So what you're saying is it's more about getting access. It's not about getting super, super fast access. It's just putting an internet connection in a house where maybe someone could watch a video about engineering or something, and it wouldn't take an entire day to download, right?
What I'm more fundamentally saying is that when you start putting money into a region through a very specific form, which is in this case a grant for broadband, which is an input for businesses and for consumers, right? It's a thing that you consume, right? So when you start doing that, you're going to change the fundamental nature of whatever that region looks like if it does not currently have a kind of demand-led system that's fast enough for broadband, right?
Yeah.
This matters a lot so some areas are effectively able to have super fast broadband and still be relatively rural because they're connected to large urban areas. But what I'm saying more fundamentally is that, for example, I mean, we keep on hinting around this, but where I'm from in Illinois, only Illinois, is not connected to anything, right? There's no major metropolitan region that's connected to that little core of 6,000 people.
Oh,
so if you put money in there, people are going to substitute out, and that entire region, its skills are going to change in a way that doesn't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily look, it looks different, but it doesn't necessarily change that region all that much. You basically have more high skilled labor and you have less low skilled labor. And so all I'm trying to say is that there's this like weird kind of shift that when you start pumping money into these rural areas, it matters a lot which rural areas you're pumping money into.
So bring it all home for me, Will. What is the key point, the key takeaway about rural broadband that if someone just glazed over and they didn't think we were funny or interesting for whatever reason, that's their problem. But if they had to think about this, what's the key takeaway?
Actions have consequences.
Actions have consequences.
Yep.
All right. Wrap it up. Well, that's it. That's all I got.
Yeah. I think that's all
I feel educated now.
Yeah. Yes. All of your questions have been answered.
Yes. Asking you shall receive answers.
Well, I guess, you know, I think we need to start doing an outro, right? We need to figure out what our outro looks like on some of these.
And it's not Wubba Lubba Dub Dub. We've established that.
No. Yep. It's definitely not that. You know, until later. We'll figure something out. We'll do this in post.
I'll try this. Thanks for listening to the Xformation podcast. Hopefully you've gotten some background on what we're going to write about more succinctly and gotten into our brains a little bit. Have a great day or night.